Sophocles wrote a classic Greek tragedy entitled Antigone, which countless high school and college theater groups have performed over the years, and students are asked to read and analyze in the course of their studies. In this classic tale, the king of Thebes, Creon, makes a decree, a vow, that any citizen who dies in battle for his enemy may not be buried, but his corpse must be left to rot. Polynices, Creon's nephew, turns against his uncle, dies outside of the city fighting for the enemy, and the king refuses to allow a burial in keeping with the decree, with the vow that he had made. Antigone is outraged at this offense to her brother. She argues that it is more important to obey the gods than a king, so she defies her uncle and she buries her brother. Creon is furious and condemns Antigone to be walled up alive inside of a cave without food or water to die an agonizing death. Creon's own son, Haman, however, is in love with Antigone and tries desperately to change his father's mind. A prophet warns King Creon, "Stubbornness and stupidity are twins." When Creon is finally convinced to change his mind, he orders the wall torn down, only to find out that Antigone has committed suicide. His son Haman, in a rage, tries to kill his father, and when he fails, he commits suicide himself. A tormented King Creon returns to the palace with the chorus in the Greek tragedy singing over and over again, "You have learned justice, though it comes too late." At the palace, he finds that his wife, Eurydice, has killed herself in despair over the death of her son. And Creon cries out, "This is my guilt, all mine." And that's a classic Greek tragedy. And college students analyze who is right and who is wrong and all the ins and outs of this kind of tragedy. Well, I think that some of those same tragic elements appear in the story of Saul and his son Jonathan, and later his relationship with David as we go through the book of 1 Samuel. Today we are in 1 Samuel 14, and we are seeing some of these tragic elements play out. First principle, stupid vows don't express true faith. Verse 24 of 1 Samuel 14. "Now the men of Israel were hard pressed on that day because Saul had put the people under an oath, under a vow, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food before evening and until I have avenged myself on my enemies.' So none of the people tasted food. And all the people of the land entered the forest, and there was honey on the ground. When the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey, but no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under oath. Therefore he put out the end of the staff that was in his hand, dipped it in the honeycomb, and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Then one of the people answered and said, 'Your father strictly put the people under oath, saying, "Cursed be the man who eats food today." And the people were weary. Then Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found? For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great." All right, let's review the facts for a minute. It was Saul's son Jonathan who had scaled the cliffs of Michmash here in this slide to attack a Philistine garrison. God had given him great victory almost single-handedly. He had forced the enemy into retreat. God delivered his people from the Philistines that day, and he used Jonathan as his catalyst in this great victory. Jonathan's father, King Saul, was 5 miles away at Gibeah, sitting under a pomegranate tree while all of this was taking place. He didn't even know that his son was attacking the Philistines until after the Philistine army was running away. So Saul then organizes his army at Gibeah to pursue the Philistines after determining that his son Jonathan had led the surprise attack. Now, did you notice how Saul turns this all around in verse 24? Now it is all about Saul. Not God, not Jonathan. He gives an order, a decree, that no one is allowed to eat any food that day until I have avenged myself on my enemies. Self-centered people have a way of turning everything into a story about them. It's all about me. This isn't about God. It isn't about delivering the people from their suffering. It isn't even about my son Jonathan and his incredible feat of courage. It is about me in Saul's story. Now, we see that happen a lot in life, don't we? We even have a tendency to turn every tragedy and triumph into stories about us. We are the center of our own stories. We are the victims of our own tragedies. Look what you have done to me, we cry. We're infected with the Saul disease. We blame others. We desire vengeance. But vengeance leads us to make some stupid vows or to say some stupid things to people. Why did Saul make this stupid vow? Well, it's always hard to speculate on the psychology of a biblical character, but I think we can make some reasonable guesses here, or observations at least. Saul is embarrassed, trying to save face to look good in front of the army. Jonathan showed him up, and pride is rearing its ugly head in Saul's life. Perhaps the soldiers are already talking about the courageous feat of his son, and pride and jealousy are setting in Saul. This is a story we will see replayed again and again in Saul's life. Samuel has already told him that he was disqualified as king, that God had rejected him as king because of his disobedience. God had removed his favor from Saul. Saul, as we shall see clearly, is trying to win God's favor back with a show of religious devotion. Taking a vow like this is impressive as a show of religious zeal, but it's stupid. How do you fight a battle all day without any food? The Israelite army chases the Philistines back into the Ajalon Valley as they're rushing back to their cities on the coast. Jonathan is in the lead along with other members of the army. They're passing through the forest overlooking that valley. They come upon some honey and honeycomb, but nobody eats. Jonathan, however, didn't hear the order. He dips his staff, he eats, and he is revived. I mean, sugar lows don't give you a whole lot of energy. Honey provides a sugar high. He's got some energy now. Perhaps he says something and then the people tell him, the other soldiers, we're under vow. We can't eat because your father put us all under vow. And Jonathan is rather blunt. Dad made a stupid vow. Well, actually what he says is he's troubled the land. In other words, he's brought us all under great distress. And then he goes on to say, if we had been allowed to eat today, we could have fought harder. And then we would have had a complete victory over the Philistines. Instead, the victory has been withdrawn. We are not able to do what we could have done because of my dad's stupid vow. That's Jonathan's assessment, and it's a correct one, of course. People do stupid things to impress other people. And that's Saul. An Oklahoma man went to extreme measures to impress his wife in 2004. Men don't do this, all right? Trent Spencer, a 27-year-old high school teacher, paid two teenagers $100 each to break into his house and tie up his wife. After she was bound with duct tape by the two teenagers, Spencer raced in and fought off the intruders. He even pre-cut a board so it would break when he hit one of the boys with it. Impressive. The police were called in and began an investigation, and the plan just might have worked, I suppose, except that one of the teenagers blabbed to his parents. You just cannot trust those teens, you know? Surprisingly, when the police found out, they didn't arrest him at all. Instead, they slapped him with a bill for the entire investigation. I'm sure his wife was real impressed with his marriage vows now. Second principle, religious rituals cannot coerce God's favor. Verse 31, and they struck among the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon. The people were very weary, and the people rushed greedily upon the spoil, took sheep and oxen and calves, slew them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. And he said, you have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone to me today. Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, each one of you bring me his ox or his sheep and slaughter it here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So all the people that night brought each one his ox with him and slaughtered it there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. So it had been a long day. The Israelite soldiers had chased the Philistines through the hill country all the way into the Ajalon Valley. The people were tired. They had not eaten food all day. It's no wonder that evening came. They were starving. The evening marked the end of the vow. You understand, in Jewish day in their time cycle, the evening is the start of the next day. So the evening marked the end of the vow. Evening came, they were hungry, they were starving, there was all kinds of food, they grabbed any animal they could get, the sheep, the ox, they killed them, they were eating it without draining the blood. Now, God in the law had specifically forbidden anyone, any Israelite, to eat food without draining the blood first. So they were sinning. They were violating the law of God by doing this. But of course they were doing it because they were so hungry from the stupid vow that Saul had made. And Saul is technically right when he talks about the failure of the people. And that's one of Saul's problems. He may be technically right, but he's not heart right. And that's what we're coming to this morning. You see, if this was truly a spiritual vow that God had asked Saul to make and the people to make, which he hadn't, then God would have given them the strength to carry it out. But God hadn't asked them to make this kind of vow. This was a show vow by Saul. When we do what God commands, then we're walking by faith. But when we create our own show of religion, then we're being presumptuous, not faithful. And that's a whole different thing. Furthermore, a truly spiritual vow brings out the best in people, not the worst. Doesn't turn them into animals eating in a frenzy of eating here. This is not of God. This was all of Saul. So Saul hears about it. The sin is brought to his attention. He acts as a religious leader. Again, he's technically correct. He orders all the people to bring animals. They slaughter on a makeshift altar. They set it up so as to atone for their sins and to properly drain the blood. But this is an example of what I keep calling the Saul disease again. He puts his faith in the technicalities, in the rituals, the outward rituals, rather than the inner heart obedience toward God. He emphasizes the show without the heart, the sacrifice without the faith. The very next chapter, Samuel will say to him, "To obey is better than sacrifice." The rituals, the technicalities, those are not what God is about. It's the heart, ultimately. I think that Saul is trying hard to impress God as well as the people with his religious zeal. God has already told him that he has rejected Saul as king because of his disobedience, and Saul is desperately trying to impress God with his zeal for religious rituals. He is desperately trying to earn God's favor back, but it's not going to work. God cares about the heart more than he cares about the rituals. When we get infected with the Saul disease, we think, well, I'm in a mess. I'll just go back to church. If I go to church regularly, then God will be impressed that I'm going back to church. You see, he'll fix my mess. Or I'll just give money to charity and God will be impressed with my money and my giving and all of the things that I'm doing for him, and he'll take care of my problems. That's Saul disease. It's trusting in the rituals, trusting in the acts rather than the heart. God's much more interested in our hearts, and he knows what's there, than he is in these kinds of things that Saul is trying to do to impress God. We cannot impress God with our zeal. Third principle, showy zeal will not invoke God's guidance. Verse 36, then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." So the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." And Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Wilt thou give them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him on that day. And Saul said, "Draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. For as the Lord lives who delivers Israel, though it is Jonathan, it is in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But not one of all the people answered him. Then he said to all Israel, "You shall be on one side, and I, Jonathan, my son, will be on the other." The people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Therefore Saul said to the Lord, "The God of Israel, give a perfect lot." And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. And Saul said, "Cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son." And Jonathan was taken. So King Saul is all excited now. He wants to take on the Philistines. He wants to do it at night. Let's go in. Let's wipe them out. Let's win this victory. He calls for the army to organize and attack that night, wipe out the Philistines. The soldiers respond, "Whatever. Do what seems good to you," actually, is what they said. But a priest raises the issue of spiritual guidance. Don't you think we ought to consult the Lord first? What a novel idea. We haven't done that all day. Saul hasn't consulted God that day, but he thinks, well, that's a good idea to ask God's guidance before continuing the battle that night. That's a religious thing to do, isn't it? That's good. God will be impressed if we pray. You're supposed to pray before you do anything, right? That's what religious people do. Prayer is a good thing. So he has the high priest with him. They ask God whether or not they should continue the fight that night. Will God give us the victory? That's his question. But we're told God is silent. God gives no answer. There's no answer from God. Now, this passage gives us the clearest picture that we have in all of the Old Testament of this process of casting lots, or the high priest's Urim and Thummim, which they kept in the breastplate of the ephod. We really don't know how the process worked, but this is as close as we get to an explanation. Very quickly, it is quite likely that the Urim and Thummim, or the casting of lots, involved two stones, and that those stones were marked in some way. Some scholars suggest they were black and white, the white meaning a positive response, the black being a negative response, or that they had the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet and the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet on them. You could only ask God yes and no questions, by the way, in this process. You couldn't ask him why. Sort of that way still, isn't it? You could only ask him yes and no questions, and then they would cast the lots. And it's always plural, by the way, in the Hebrew, so it's likely they were more. There was more than one casting of the lot. In other words, perhaps there were three, and you took the sum total or something like that. But they would cast the lots, and if it came up, yes, the white side came up on both stones, then that's a yes. Black side comes up, that's a no. If white and black come up, that's a non-answer. Okay? That's a maybe. It's a non-answer. All right, well, it came up with a non-answer. What's God trying to tell them? Well, Saul concludes that there was sin in the camp since God did not answer his question. He jumps to that conclusion. It never occurs to him that he might be the problem, of course, but there's got to be sin in the camp when God doesn't answer. That's our history. Achan, whatever. There's sin in the camp. So let's find out what the sin is. Someone has sinned. God's not answering me because someone else has sinned. God's punishing us for that sin. So Saul gathers all the leaders together. By the way, isn't that the way we work a lot of times, you know? God's silent. I'm not getting the answers I want. Somebody must have given me a problem. Right? It must be somebody else's fault. Anyway, he gathers the leaders together, demands an answer, and he makes his second stupid vow. He says, "Whoever has done it, if it is Jonathan my son, he will die." He swears by God that whoever has sinned, even if it's Jonathan, they will die. Now, it's actually quite possible that Saul already suspected it was Jonathan. You see, he already knew that Jonathan had left. He knew that Jonathan was not there when the vow was taken in the first place, because Jonathan was off fighting the Philistines when it happened. And you remember back in the story that Jonathan, we're specifically told, Jonathan did not tell his father what he was doing. There's already problems here. And it's very possible that he already suspected Jonathan. And he separates, he says, we'll get right to the heart of this, doesn't he? We don't go through a process of clan by clan by clan by clan. It's all of you and Jonathan and me. We'll get right to this. And God, he says, God, give me a clear answer this time. And God does. And Jonathan is taken. The Puritan pastor Jonathan Edwards was a leader in the Great Awakening of the 1700s, but he was also an astute observer of human behavior. And he knew that many people put on a good show of religious zeal. He said it better than anyone, I think. A person may be full of talk about his own religious experiences, but often it is more a bad than a good sign. It is like a tree that is full of leaves that seldom bears much fruit, or it is like a cloud which, although it appears to promise much fullness of rain, is only wind to a dry and thirsty earth. Strong, false affections are much more likely to declare themselves than true ones. It is the nature of false religion to be showy and visible, as it was with the Pharisees. He's right on target. That's the way it often is in life. But the story continues. False faith does not obscure real faith. The people know the difference, don't they? Look at verse 43. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." So Jonathan told him and said, "I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I must die." And Saul said, "May God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." But the people said to Saul, "Must Jonathan die, who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. So we finally have the confrontation that has been building since earlier in the day when Saul learned that his son had defeated the Philistines almost single-handedly. We can't tell body language or tone of voice by written word, can you? But we suspect that Jonathan's answer here has quite a note of at least irony, probably sarcasm in it. Something to the effect of, "All right, I had a little bit of honey. I gotta die, I guess. That makes sense." And his father says, "You shall surely die." Now that is one stupid vow. But it's show. It's all about me, and I will not be upstaged. That's Saul's viewpoint. It's pretty clear from the story that Jonathan didn't think much of his father's lack of leadership here. But it's still hard to believe that Saul would have killed his own son. And yet that's what we have in the story. Except for the people. See, the people finally rise up. Up until now, they've said whatever every time Saul said to do something, whatever you want. But now they rise up and they mutiny and they say, "No, this will not take place." The people can clearly discern, between Saul's false faith and Jonathan's real faith, and they choose Jonathan over his father. He is, after all, the hero of Michmash. Winston Churchill once said, "A fanatic is one who can't change his mind and won't change the subject." Saul's pride won't let him change his mind. His jealousy won't let him change the subject. He has made a vow, he will carry it out no matter what the consequences. By the way, later in the book of 1 Samuel, we're going to meet David. And David will also make a stupid vow. He will vow to kill Nabal and all his household for an offense to David. And Abigail will come and intercede on behalf of her husband and the family. And David will change his mind. "I made a stupid vow, I'm not carrying it out." Saul is a fanatic. David is a believer, a follower of God. You don't have to carry out stupid vows. Two wrongs don't make a right. And we have that very stark contrast between Saul and David in this book, and Saul and Jonathan too. Representative Barbara Connable once said, "Hell hath no fury like a vested interest masquerading as a moral principle." Saul's a fool. And so are we when we hide our own pride and jealousy behind some grand moral conviction or principle. And we carry out revenge in the name of God. How many times has that happened in church history? Grand moral conviction, but what's really happening is jealous heart, pride. It can happen in Christians dealing with the culture wars here in the United States of America, where we emphasize grand moral convictions, but what is really driving us is our own pride. Jealousy. It can happen in family disputes, in church disputes, where we have moral principle out here for everyone to see, and it looks so good, but what's really driving us inside is, I'm going to get him. He's going to pay. She's going to pay. See? Fifth principle. Partial obedience does not produce full peace. Verse 47. Now when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, the sons of Ammon, Edom, the sons of the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines, and wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment, and he acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishvi and Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these: the name of the firstborn Merab, and the name of the younger Michal. The name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the captain of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. And Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. So God gave Saul great success in life. God was faithful to Saul and to his people. In many ways, Saul achieved exactly what the Israelites wanted when they asked for a king. He fought for them. He led them in battle. He defeated their enemies. He led the battles against Ammon and Edom and Moab and the Amalekites. He expanded the Israelite kingdom. He established at least a measure of security for the people. God honored Saul publicly. In this summary, we can see it. He gave him success. Saul was not a total failure, though he failed personally in his personal life many times. He was a tormented man inside, but he had considerable success with the nation. He was outwardly fairly successful, but inwardly his heart was never right with God. He was not a man after God's own heart. There was one foe, Saul never fully defeated the Philistines. Today, the area of Philistines that the Philistines controlled is still the battleground. All the days of Saul's life, he paid for not completing the process in that very first battle. And that note is made at the end of this summary for a reason. Partial obedience brought partial victory over the Philistines. Saul and Jonathan will both die at the hands of the Philistines at the end of this book. A sad ending to a tragic family. Even more importantly for Saul is the inner turmoil we see already developing in the opening days of his reign. The seeds of jealousy have been sown in Saul's heart, and those seeds will bear a fruit that poisons his soul, because that's what jealousy does. God took his favor away from Saul, and Saul took out his rage first on his own son Jonathan. Saul will be consumed with the bitterness of Samuel's rejection, of God's rejection, and of course will eventually take out his jealousy on David, pursuing him with a vengeance later in life. Jealousy and pride will destroy the soul from the inside out, and that is the story of Saul in a nutshell. A fascinating study by Professor Vicki Medvec reveals how our attitudes affect our lives. Medvec studied Olympic medalists and discovered, interestingly enough, that bronze medalists were happier than silver medalists. Now, silver medalist, that's second place, right? Bronze medal, that's third place. You would think you would be happier if you won second than third. Not true. Bronze medalists are much happier than silver medalists. You know why? Because the silver medalists focused on how close they had come and what they had missed out on, the gold medal. The bronze medalists looked the other way. They focused on the fact that they could have missed all medals altogether, and they had won a bronze medal. So they were much happier than the silver medalist. Now, isn't that an interesting insight into human behavior? Saul never could get over what he missed out on. Jonathan will live forever a life of faithfulness to God and to his father, to family and friends. Where does it start? Your attitude, right? It's in the heart. It's your perspective. Peace and contentment don't come from outside circumstances. They don't come from winning the medal. They come from inside us and how we react to those circumstances. A show of religion without a heart for God results in public success many times without personal peace. Do you ever feel that if anyone found out the truth about you, you'd be finished? You go through life basically trying to convince others, to impress others, that you are something you are not. John Corcoran knows what that's like. During grade school, he never learned to read or write, but he caused a lot of trouble, somehow kept getting promoted to the next grade. He got to high school, he mastered new skills. He says, "I started cheating by turning in other people's papers. I dated the valedictorian and ran around with college prep kids. I couldn't read words, but I could read the system and I could read people." So he graduated. He received an athletic scholarship to Texas Western College, and he cheated his way through there as well, getting a degree in teacher training, in education, of all things. Somehow he got a job as a teacher, and for the next 17 years he taught in high school, and he couldn't read or write a word. He says, "What I did was I created an oral and visual environment. There wasn't the written word in there in the classroom. I always had two or three teachers' assistants in each class to do board work or read the bulletin." 17 years. Finally, he left teaching, became a real estate developer. Later in life, he learned to read and write and became an advocate for better educational systems. Folks, in a sense, we're often like John Corcoran. Most of us don't have to fake reading and writing in life, but we can end up faking our faith. To convince ourselves, impress others, and even God that we're good and we're good enough for Him. We come to communion this morning. Let's take the time to reflect and evaluate whether our faith is real or fake as we celebrate God's grace, because we are no good in ourselves. It is His grace that counts. Father, change our hearts daily to follow You from the inside out. And as we reflect on Your grace, we realize that we are no good, no matter how much we try to impress others. And we seek Your grace to be active in our hearts, making us into the people You want us to be. In Jesus' name, amen.